And now, live from the Daniel Scappin Studio, deep in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains, it's Mike Malloy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to tonight's program. This is the 7th, isn't it? 7th of June, 2018. Yeah, we were off last night, but we're not off tonight. We're back. And we had a sponsor last night that we will just fold into tonight, if it's all right with you, Linda. Linda Conroy. Thank you, Linda. Her message is, come on, fellow truth seekers, help Mike keep it lit. We need him more than ever. And Brian Woolman. Thanks, Brian. His message for tonight, keep up the great podcast. Well, that's kind of you to say that. And you, Linda. Thanks to both of you, Linda and Brian. I do appreciate your sponsorship very much. And let me just mention it again. We still have, what's the date today, the 7th? We have about 2 weeks that this fundraiser is running. It stops when summer begins. And if you haven't sponsored, this is a good time to do it. It's only $50. It's half price. And that will get you the sponsorship of the program, along with any of your fellow truth seekers who happen to join in that night. All right? Yeah, last week we had a marriage proposal. I wonder how that went.
We never heard.
Is that good? Well, you know, they say no news is good news. So maybe it worked. I have some bizarre stuff tonight. And I think it's because we really are going through kind of a sociological meltdown, a political meltdown. I don't know where we're going to wind up. But I don't think anyone can disagree that Trump and his crime family, his gangsters, are destroying everything. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Even the Christian nutcases would say, well, yeah, he's destroying stuff, but that's what God wants, you know. It is getting bizarre-er. And I spend more time than I want to thinking about what a possible outcome could be. I'm doing physical therapy now a couple of days a week, and my therapist is a tough son of a bitch. I don't know. I think he might have been a former Marine drill sergeant, but he has no mercy. But when I'm going through the stuff he's putting me through, he doesn't have television or radio or anything in this facility. All he has are the equipment. And that gives me a lot of time to just think, to cogitate, to regurgitate, to freak out, frankly. And that happened again today. I had therapy today. And when I got home, I found a moment with Bob was waiting for me in my email. And I'll be damned if what Bob wrote, and Bob and I haven't talked in what, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? We have a lot of, well, not a lot, but we have a considerable amount of contact via email. Well, not even that. But in so many ways, in all the years I've known Bob Alexander, he and I are pretty much on the same cynical page. So I get home today and go through the email to see what, you know, which ones I can handle. Well, by the way, if you write to me, email me, and don't get an answer, it doesn't mean I haven't read it. It just means I'm not very good at answering email. That's all. Anyway, so there's this email, this moment with Bob. Have you got the moment with Bob music? Okay, don't start it now. No, not now. You have a new mini disc player, I see. Where did you get that?
eBay.
Well, good. So now all the music should work. whoop-de-doo, right? So I print out A Moment with Bob, and I'll be damned if it isn't similar to what I was thinking today when a physical therapist had me doing clamshells. Clamshells with rubber restraints. It sounds like fun, doesn't it? Trust me, it isn't. All right. Music maestro, another moment with Bob. Can you pot it up a little bit? Maybe even more. Oh, it is? I guess I'm just not getting it. Another moment with Bob brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's moment is entitled Anything Can Happen Day. Hey, Mike. I keep a pen and notepad on my nightstand, so when I get an idea as I drift off to sleep, I can write it down before I forget it. I started doing this years ago because no matter how many times I'd say to myself, I won't forget this, the next morning when I got to the computer, the idea would be gone, gone, gone. I'm not saying they were all good ideas because I don't know how good or bad any idea is until I start typing it out. I can usually tell about a third of the way through whether or not I should keep going or throw it in the garbage. But if the idea has vanished in the night, there's nothing to get the ball rolling. At the top of the notepad, I wrote this. Fucko the clown is a lying sack of shit. I didn't write that down to remind me of that miserable fact. I wrote it down to remind myself that Fucko the clown hasn't actually done anything. The headlines in the news about how Fucko did this or Fucko's done that. But the reality is Fucko the clown has not done anything. He's a lazy, lying sack of shit who watches TV 8 hours a day, tweets bullshit about what he sees on television, and eats cheeseburgers before he goes to bed. On any given day, he might squeeze in an hour and a half or 2 hours of actual work. And that work entails meeting with his people who tell him generally what's going on in the world. I say generally because his people have learned to leave out the details. Details bore him. Fucko did not work until the wee hours of the morning crafting the health care proposal that would gut health care for millions of people, or the massive tax cuts for the obscenely wealthy. Fucko didn't do any of that shit. He just signs his name to pieces of paper in front of the cameras. But Fucko actually does one thing very well. He sets the tone of his administration. He's given permission to those Americans who want to make xenophobia and racism great again. Mission accomplished. Every single drop of the misery we've seen since Inauguration Day is due to the rat bastard Republicans and the corrupt Democrats who go along with them. But they are just meat puppets jerking to the strings pulled by the donor class. For over 500 days, the oligarchs have been calling the shots while they reshape the United States into their vision of the future. I could make a long, long list of horrors, but right now I just want to focus on one thing. But first, I have to tell you about an old movie. Paramount released 7 Days in May in 1964. Rod Serling wrote the screenplay and John Frankenheimer directed it. Frankenheimer, by the way, directed The Manchurian Candidate a few years earlier and was well-suited to make another political thriller. The plot. Kirk Douglas, playing a Marine Corps colonel and Pentagon insider, discovers that Burt Lancaster's character, leader of the Joint Chiefs, is fomenting a coup d'etat to remove the president and his entire cabinet. The coup will begin in 7 days. Douglas alerts the president, played by Frederick March, and they work to stop the coup, to thwart the coup. One of the subplots concerns an ally of the president, a senator played by Edmund O'Brien, who is sent to uncover a secret army base in Texas that will be used during the coup attempt. But the senator is arrested when he tries to enter the base. And a bunch of other shit happens, which I won't go into because I don't do spoilers. The reason I brought up this movie was because I remember how shocked I was watching the scene when the senator was arrested for trying to enter a military base. These people were serious and did not give a rat's ass about roughing up a United States senator. But that was just a scene in a movie. Fast forward 54 years to a couple of days ago. United States Senator Jeff Merkley was denied entry to an ICE child detention center, a converted Walmart in Brownsville, Texas. Instead of letting the senator into the facility that houses 1,000 children, the cops were called and the senator and his crew were turned away. Merkley inspected another facility in McAllen, Texas, which he described as horrific. Children in cages. 3-year-olds lined up for food with 17-year-olds. Children separated from their parents. Here's the deal. Most of the coverage I've seen gives the impression that these children are from families who were arrested attempting to illegally cross the border. But these are children from families who came to the border because they were seeking asylum. These aren't illegal immigrants. They're refugees. As Merkley said in a phone interview with Time magazine, quote, "Are we really putting children through a traumatic experience here in the United States in order to dissuade their parents from seeking asylum?" End quote. The message is loud and clear. Do not come to the United States if you are seeking political protection from the wars and violence in your home country, because if you do, the United States will tear your family apart. The windows and doors of the converted Walmart in Brownsville, Texas, are literally blacked out. We can't see what is happening to those 1,000 children inside the detention center. I can't imagine it. Can you? I've been in jail, a drunk tank, and a treatment center. They're human zoos, more or less. The treatment center was certainly more pleasant, but still a zoo. The fact that the government of the United States puts little kids in fucking detention centers, a fucking zoo, because their families had the audacity to want a better life, should make us all wonder just how far the donor class is willing to go to realize their malignant dreams. When I was a kid, I'd turn on the television and watch the Mickey Mouse Club. Each day of the week had a different theme. On Wednesdays, it was Anything Can Happen Day. Now, with the donor class in charge of the government and with Fuckle the Clown entertaining the rubes from the center ring, every day is Anything Can Happen Day. From Time magazine, June 6, 2018. Quote, "Graduating eighth graders from a school in Pennsylvania were given bulletproof shields for their backpacks Monday in preparation for high school. One student said, 'I never thought I'd need this.' Anything can happen. Anything. Regards, Bob." Another Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. By the way, Bob has a website, Bob Alexander. What's his web address? I don't think it's Super Beans, no. Yeah, Bob, send us, I should have it, but if you're listening, if you would send your website address, I'll put it out there. Because I think everything that Bob and I have done together, Bob and Kathy and I and Molly, everything we have done, I think, is at that website. All the old Radio Gumshoe bits, the Moments with Bob. It's a goddamn veritable library. That ought to be worth something. A couple bucks. Another moment with Bob. Oh, my goodness. Now, because of the nature of tonight's program, what I said is going to be a little bit odd, weird. I'm going to be quoting from several different pieces, just like Bob Alexander's piece I just did. And the reason for that is because what other people say by writing an op-ed column or a magazine piece or whatever that I find extremely pertinent to what's going on and very important, their words are a lot more to the point than mine would be on the same topic. And the reason for it, I think, is part of the reason for it is obvious. It takes time to sit down and write an op-ed piece. It takes time to write A Moment with Bob. It takes time to write a piece for New Yorker magazine. And so tonight I will be sharing with you a couple of pieces verbatim, just like The Moment with Bob. This one comes from John Brennan, who served as director of the CIA from March 2013 until January 2017. And this was in the Washington Post. Here's what John Brennan wrote. My first visit to the Oval Office came in October 1990, when I was a 35-year-old CIA officer. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait 2 months before, and President George H.W. Bush wanted to discuss the implications of a U.S.-led military coalition that would ultimately push the Iraqis out. I remember the nervousness I felt when I entered that room and met a president of the United States for the first time. By the time the meeting ended, his intellectual curiosity, wisdom, affability, and intense interest in finding the best policy course to protect and promote U.S. interests were abundantly evident. Over the next quarter century, I returned to the Oval Office several hundred times during the administrations of Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. The jitters that accompanied my first Oval Office visit dissipated over time, but the respect, awe, and admiration I held for the office of the presidency and the incumbents never waned. The presidents I directly served were not perfect, and I didn't agree with all their policy choices. But I never doubted that each treated their solemn responsibility to lead our nation with anything less than the seriousness, intellectual rigor, and principles that it deserved. Many times I heard them dismiss the political concerns of their advisors, saying, quote, I don't care about my politics. It's the right thing to do, end quote. The esteem with which I held the presidency was dealt a serious blow when Donald Trump took office. Almost immediately, I began to see a startling aberration from the remarkable, though human, presidents I had served. Mr. Trump's lifelong preoccupation with aggrandizing himself seemed to intensify in office, and he quickly leveraged his 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue address and his Twitter handle to burnish his brand and misrepresent reality. Presidents throughout the years have differed in their approaches to policy based on political platforms, ideologies, and individual beliefs. Mr. Trump, however, has shown highly abnormal behavior by lying routinely to the American people without compunction, intentionally fueling divisions in our country, and actively working to degrade the imperfect but critical institutions of service. Although appalling, these actions shouldn't be surprising. As was the case throughout his business and entertainment careers, Mr. Trump charts his every move according to a calculus of how it will personally help or hurt him. His strategy is to undercut real potential and perceived opponents. His focus is to win at all costs, irrespective of truth, ethics, decency, and, many would argue, the law. His disparagement of institutions is designed to short-circuit legitimate law enforcement investigations, intelligence assessments, and media challenges that threaten his interests. His fear of the special counsel work is especially palpable, as is his growing interest in destroying its mandate. For more than three decades, I observed and analyzed the traits and tactics of corrupt, incompetent, and narcissistic foreign officials who did whatever they thought was necessary to retain power. Exploiting the fears and concerns of their citizenry, these demagogues routinely relied on lies, deceit, and suppression of political opposition to cast themselves as populist heroes and to mask self-serving priorities. By gaining control of intelligence and security services, stifling the independence of the judiciary, and discrediting a free press, these authoritarian rulers followed a time-tested recipe for how to inhibit democracy's development, retard individual freedoms and liberties, and reserve the spoils of corrupt governance for themselves and their ilk. It never dawned on me that we could face such a development in the United States. On the international front, Mr. Trump pursues policies that are rooted in uninformed campaign promises, a determination to upend actions of his predecessors, and an aversion to multilateral engagements. His ad hoc and frequently impulsive approach to national security is short-sighted and dangerous, as allies and partners are left uncertain about U.S. strategy and objectives. The impact of the Trump presidency will be felt for many years to come. Most worrisome is that his use of falsehoods, his mean-spirited and malicious behavior, and his self-absorption will be emulated by many young Americans, indeed young people globally, who look to the President of the United States as a role model. The damage also will be felt by the millions of Americans who believe in Mr. Trump because of their concern about being left behind in a rapidly globalizing world. These Americans have a legitimate gripe that politicians and political parties of all stripes have failed to deliver on the promise that America is a land of opportunity for all, irrespective of race, creed, or place of residence. At a time when deep-seated fears of socioeconomic and cultural change need to be addressed honestly and without prejudice, Mr. Trump grandstands like a snake oil salesman, squandering his formidable charisma and communication skills in favor of ego, selfishness, and false promises. Many have condemned my public criticism of Mr. Trump, arguing that as a former CIA director, I should bite my tongue. My criticisms, however, are not political. I have never been and will never be a partisan. I speak out for the simple reason that Mr. Trump is failing to live up to the standards that we should all expect of a president. As someone who has had the rare privilege of directly serving four presidents, I will continue to speak out loudly and critically until integrity, decency, wisdom, and maybe even some humility return to the White House. John Brennan, former director of the CIA. Now, if I may, of course I may. What do you mean if I may? I'm not in a debate, right, Kathy? I think we all can take a look at what happened in Iraq the first time under George Herbert Walker Bush. And we can conclude, John Brennan was not director of the CIA then. We can conclude that, or I can conclude anyway, that so much of the information that was used to invade Iraq the first time was bullshit. And we certainly can conclude that the invasion of 2003 was even worse. It was a war crime of monumental proportion. And we can also agree, I think, that in the past, the CIA has not burnished its reputation by being honest, forthright, exactly what Brennan is talking about where it concerns Trump. But we can, I think, maybe not, we can, I think, given the circumstances of what is leading this country now, we can say that the actions of Trump, the criminal actions of Trump, the destructive actions of Trump, have gotten the attention of people who have worked in the intelligence agencies, who probably are willing to, if not confess, at least own some of the actions they took that were less than honorable. It's hard to tell anymore. But for me, to have someone like John Brennan make these kinds of statements about Trump, which are certainly parallel mine, I mean, John Brennan doesn't call him an evil son of a bitch. I do. But I think Brennan might feel some of that. So given all that, I choose to give some credence, more than some credence, to what Brennan is saying. And it's not just Brennan. You know, I never thought that this country could be led by the moral and temperamental equivalent of an 8-year-old. But here we are. And again, it's what we do about it that will determine who we are. We're about to take a little break here. Let me mention again our sponsors tonight, Linda Conroy. Thank you, Linda. Her message, come on, fellow truth seekers, help Mike keep it lit. We need him more than ever. And Brian Wollman, Brian's message, keep up the great podcast. Thanks, Linda. Thanks, Brian. We'll be right back. Flashing down the long dirt road when they asked me to step out. I said, we've been looking for illegal immigrants. Can we check your car? Saying, no, it's funny, I think we were on the same boat back in 1694. And I said, everybody be careful. Oh, everybody be careful. Oh, everybody be careful. You know, everybody, I've said this so many times, and you don't need me to tell you, everybody associated with Trump is a liar. That is a requirement. If you are not willing to lie your ass off, you don't last very long in the Trump mafia organization. The latest, of course, is Rudy Giuliani, who just – Giuliani just makes shit up as he goes along. Of course, so does his boss. But Giuliani went, you know, an inch too far. Giuliani is in Israel, I think. Yeah, he was at a capital market conference in Tel Aviv. And during an interview there with local media, I guess, he said some things about Melania Trump. Among them, Giuliani said that Melania, quote, believes her husband, end quote, about Stormy Daniels' allegation of this affair with Trump. However, Stephanie Grisham, who is Melania Trump's press person or spokeswoman, she said, quote, I don't believe Mrs. Trump has ever discussed her thoughts on anything with Mr. Giuliani, end quote. Ow! I don't believe Mrs. Trump has ever discussed her thoughts on anything with Mr. Giuliani. Giuliani did not immediately respond to requests for comments from Business Insider, where this was published. But Giuliani is just a lying snake. I mean, he's never gotten this much publicity except when he moved his girlfriend in when he was mayor of New York, moved his girlfriend in without telling his wife. I mean, he's really a piece of shit. I mean, let's just put it where it is. Giuliani's a piece of shit. All this America's mayor stuff, you know, everybody in this country went mentally off kilter quite a bit after the attack of 9/11, 2001. We were all a little bit blotto. We saw George W. Bush as a true leader. We saw Rudy Giuliani as somebody who held the country together, both of which is bullshit. What held the country together was the fact that we didn't freak out. That's a whole different topic. But Giuliani is perfect for Trump. And so is this little prick Hannity. I mean, the three of them together is the perfect Three Stooges. It's just, I mean, you couldn't find three more ignorant people working for Trump than Trump, Giuliani, and Hannity. Terrible shit. You know how Trump has repeated over and over and over again that there's no collusion. I don't know Putin. I never talk with him. Oh, horseshit. According to Putin himself, Putin and Trump talk on the phone regularly. He told an Austrian reporter, Putin did, quote, "Indeed, Donald Trump and I have firstly met more than once at various international venues, and secondly, we regularly talk over the phone." The Hill reports that official White House statements put the number of calls between the two at 8 since Trump took office. 8. And Putin, someone that I think Donald Trump really would like to have sex with, he says, "No, we talk every day." And by the way, what Putin said follows a remark from the dean of the state-run University of Moscow, which is where all good Russian students hope to go someday. Anyway, this statement came out this week and cited what the dean of that university called the American God, Trump, and U.S. voters in the fate of the European Union. This is what the dean of Moscow State University said, quote, "The European Union is coming apart at the seams thanks to American God and voters. Trump is smashing it with a sledgehammer. That's why Putin says he isn't trying to weaken the European Union. Why would he bother? Trump is doing all the work for him." I hope there's still time to remove Trump from office legally and peacefully. Now, the another thing that happened, was it today or yesterday? I guess it was yesterday. There was a meeting that was supposed to be about hurricane preparedness because the National Weather Service or the whoever puts together these, I guess it's not the National Weather Service, I don't know, Hurricane Center, FEMA, whatever. The climatologists have put together a report that says 2018, this year, is going to be a mindfuck where it concerns hurricanes. Now, we've heard that before, and sometimes it happens horribly. Sometimes the hurricane season passes and not a whole lot of death and destruction occurs. What happened to Puerto Rico is something that's going to be a stain on this country because these are our fellow American citizens forever. There's no removing the stain of what the Trump administration has done to Puerto Rico. It's just, it's going to become part of history. But the meeting was supposed to be about hurricane preparedness, and the meeting was comprised of disaster officials who got together at the FEMA agency headquarters a couple of days after the start of the 2018 hurricane season. But according to the Washington Post, Trump had a lot of other things on his mind, and he turned this closed-door discussion. Now, remember why they're there. They're there to talk about preparedness for hurricanes, for death and destruction, what to do. Trump turned the closed-door discussion into soliloquies on his prowess in negotiating airplane deals, his popularity, the effectiveness of his political endorsements, the Republican Party's fortunes, the vagaries of Defense Department purchasing guidelines, his dislike of magnetized launch equipment on aircraft carriers, his unending love of coal, and his breezy optimism about his planned Singapore summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. According to an audio of the FEMA meeting that the Washington Post got, Trump said, quote, "It's an interesting journey." He's talking about meeting with North Korean leader. "It's an interesting journey. It's called the land of the unknown. Who knows? We'll maybe make a deal, maybe not. As I say to everybody, are you going to make a deal? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows?" He spoke for about 40 minutes behind closed doors, and he spoke to cameras for about 15 minutes after that closed-door meeting. He briefly mentioned Puerto Rico, where health authorities, I think I mentioned this earlier this week, now estimate there were about 4,000 deaths following Hurricane Maria. Hundreds of thousands of people, American citizens in Puerto Rico, still have no electricity. He didn't mention Puerto Rico's victims, but he thanked Florida Governor Rick Scott for helping. And he noted that the power company was, quote, the Puerto Rican power company was, quote, in bankruptcy prior to the hurricane. The fuck does that mean? Trump's been in bankruptcy how many times? When Trump goes into bankruptcy, he just fucks everybody that provided him capital or assets to do his scams to the point where he couldn't get financing anymore. That's when he turned to the Russians. That's when he turned to the oligarchs. That'll come out later. He said the Puerto Rican recovery was, quote, a tough job. He said, quote, there's never been a season like the last 12 or 13 months. I've never seen anything like it. Hurricane briefings are usually moments when politicians have a chance to look decisive and important and like they're doing something. And according to the Washington Post, Trump bragged to friends last fall that his administration had handled a slew of hurricanes quite well. However, his thoughts today in this meeting didn't relate to hurricanes, although that's what the meeting was about. When Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan began speaking, Trump, within 10 seconds, interrupted and moved the conversation to negotiating airplane prices. He said the government was getting ripped off on ships and planes because, quote, the ordering process for the military is so bad. It's not a competitive bid. It's so bad. It's awful. We saved $1.6 billion on Air Force One. Can you believe it? I got involved in the negotiations. The press refuses to report that. But that's okay. People were really surprised. End quote. Military officials don't know what the fuck he's talking about. Where he got $1.6 billion. A defense Department official told Bloomberg News that the Defense Department had no information to back up that claim. Trump added, quote, I got involved with Boeing, was able to cut down the F-18 by millions of dollars, end quote. He then complained that the U.S. military was too frequently buying new and, in his view, unnecessary equipment. He cited aircraft technology as an example. This is what he said, quote, see if you can follow this. Part of it is they want to have all new. Instead of having the system that throws the aircraft off the ship, which was always steam, they now have magnets. They're using magnets instead of steam. They spent hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm hearing not great things about it. It's frankly ridiculous. End quote. Everybody in that room didn't know what the fuck to say about that, so they all shut up. Shanahan, the assistant guy, said he would brief Trump and Kelly on changes to the guidelines soon and would begin bringing him receipts. Trump said he appreciated that. Trump went on to tout generic polls that show Republicans closing the gap in the midterm elections before he dismissed the idea of generic polls. He said this, quote, I don't know. He said the Republican Party was down 17 points 2 months ago in one unnamed poll. Just bullshit made up out of his head. Now he said that was changing. This is what he said, quote, I don't know if that means anything. I've never heard of a generic poll. I'm not sure I believe in a generic poll when you have so many races between the Senate and the House. We've never been up in a generic poll. And now we're up in two of them. The Republican Party has never been up in generic polls. And now it's up in two of them. He went on, quote, we're setting records like we've never seen before, whether it's the employment records I went over, whether it's the number of companies pouring into the country. We have tremendous number of companies coming back. Nobody had any idea this is going to happen. I did. Things are happening that they've never seen before. End quote. He encouraged Energy Secretary Rick Goodhair Perry to make an announcement about helping coal companies. Quote the president, I'd love to put it out. Clean coal, nuclear. It's a very important message. End quote. He said Rick Perry needed to have a news conference. Oh, God. More than anything, Trump was determined to convince the cabinet members that were in this meeting that he was doing a terrific job. And that they were, too. In private, Trump has derided many of his cabinet members and has fired several. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who has repeatedly clashed with Trump over immigration, thanked him for his, quote, unfailing support of the department. Trump said, quote, I understand a big story is being done in a major newspaper talking about what a great cabinet this is, what a great cabinet this has turned out to be. Our level of popularity is great. End quote. This is a meeting to discuss hurricane preparedness. And there were other reports about what happened in that meeting and subsequent to the meeting. And apparently when people came out of that meeting, even the Trump suckers who would give the guy a blowjob if it meant that he would look at them and pat them on the head and say, good dog. But even those people came out kind of blotto, like, what the fuck just happened? But they won't say a word. The Republicans won't say a word. The cabinet won't say a word. The Democrats are making little squeaking noises, which doesn't amount to a hill of shit, not really. Now, in this next part of the program, I want to share with you, in the April 30th issue of The New Yorker, there is a typical, fairly lengthy New Yorker article by Alex Ross entitled The Hitler Vortex, subtitled How American Racism Influenced Nazi Thought. And what Alex does here, he mentions that there's an adage in publishing that you can never go wrong with books about Lincoln, Hitler, and dogs. He said there have been hundreds of titles that appear each year about Hitler, and the total number runs into the tens of thousands. Different books written. And he gives little thumbnail sketches of some of them. And I'm reading this, started reading the other day, and I'm reading it today. And I learned some things that I think you might find interesting, too. You ready? I remember I used to read from 1984, so I think it's – to me, it's important to get this out, to include this in this podcast. Again, it's from the New Yorker, April 30th issue. I'm starting like a third of the way – or two-thirds of the way through. Hitler and Goebbels were the first relativizers of the Holocaust, the first purveyors of false equivalents. Hitler said in 1941, quote, concentration camps were not invented here in Germany. It's the English who are their inventors, using this institution to gradually break the backs of other nations, end quote. The British had operated camps in South Africa, the Nazis pointed out. Party propagandists similarly highlighted the suffering of Native Americans and Stalin's slaughter in the Soviet Union. In 1943, Goebbels triumphantly broadcast news of the Katyn Forest Massacre, in the course of which the Soviet secret police killed more than 20,000 Poles. Nazi sympathizers carry on this project today, alternately denying the Holocaust and explaining it away. The magnitude of the abomination almost forbids that it be mentioned in the same breath as any other horror. Yet the Holocaust has unavoidable international dimensions, lines of influence, circles of complicity, moments of congruence. Hitler's so-called scientific anti-Semitism, as he called it, echoed the French racial theorist Arthur de Gobineau and anti-Semitic intellectuals who normalized venomous language during the Dreyfus Affair. The British Empire was Hitler's ideal image of a master race in dominant repose. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a Russian forgery from around 1900, fueled the Nazi paranoia. The Armenian genocide of 1915 and 1916 encouraged the belief that the world community would care little about the fate of the Jews. Just before the outbreak of the Second World War, Hitler spoke of the planned mass murder of Poles, and he asked, quote, who, after all, is today speaking about the destruction of the Armenians? End quote. The Nazis found collaborators in almost every country that they invaded. In one Lithuanian town, a crowd cheered while a local man clubbed dozens of Jewish people to death. He then stood atop the corpses and played the Lithuanian anthem on an accordion. German soldiers looked on, taking photographs. The mass killings by Stalin and Hitler existed in an almost symbiotic relationship, the one giving license to the other, in remorseless cycles of revenge. Large-scale deportations of Jews from the countries of the Third Reich followed upon Stalin's deportation of the Volga Germans. Reinhard Heydrich, one of the chief planners of the Holocaust, thought that once the Soviet Union had been defeated, the Jews of Europe could be left to die in the Gulag. The most dangerous claim made by right-wing historians during this period was that Nazi terror was a response to Bolshevik terror and was therefore to some degree excusable. One can, however, keep the entire monstrous landscape in view without minimizing the culpability of perpetrators on either side. And this was achieved by Timothy Snyder's profoundly disturbing book published in 2010, Bloodlands, which seems to fix cameras in spots across Eastern Europe, recording wave upon wave of slaughter. As for Hitler and America, the issue goes beyond such obvious suspects as Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh. Whitman's Hitler's American Model, with its comparative analysis of American and Nazi race law, joins such previous studies as Carol Kaekel's The American West and the Nazi East, a side-by-side discussion of Manifest Destiny here, and Lebensraum in Germany, and Stefan Kuhl's The Nazi Connection, which describes the impact of the American eugenics movement on Nazi thinking. This literature is provocative in tone and at times tendentious, but it engages in a necessary act of self-examination, a kind of modern Germany, a kind that modern Germany has exemplified. The Nazis were not wrong to cite American precedents. Enslavement of African Americans was written into the U.S. Constitution. Thomas Jefferson spoke of the need to, his word, eliminate or extirpate Native Americans. In 1856, an Oregonian settler wrote, quote, "Extermination, however unchristian-like it may appear, seems to be the only resort left for the protection of life and property," end quote. General Philip Sheridan spoke of, quote, "annihilation, obliteration, and complete destruction," end quote. To be sure, others promoted more peaceful, albeit still repressive, policies. The historian Edward Westerman in Hitler's Ostkrieg and the Indian Wars concludes that because federal policy never officially mandated the, quote, "physical annihilation of the native population on racial grounds or characteristics," end quote, this was not a genocide on the order of the Shoah. The fact remains, however, that between the years 1500 and 1900, the native population of U.S. territories dropped from many millions to around 200,000. In 1990, Vanity Fair reported that Donald Trump once kept a book of Hitler's speeches by his bed. When Trump was asked about it, he said, quote, "If I had these speeches, and I'm not saying that I do, but if I had these speeches, I would never read them," end quote. Since Trump entered politics, he has repeatedly been compared to Hitler, not least by neo-Nazis themselves, although some resemblances can be found. For example, at times, Trump seems to be emulating Hitler's strategy of cultivating rivalries among those under him, and his rallies are cathartic rituals of racism, xenophobia, and self-regard. The differences, however, are obvious and stark. For one thing, Hitler had more discipline. What is worth pondering is how a demagogue of Hitler's malign skill might more effectively exploit flaws in American democracy. He would certainly have at his disposal craven right-wing politicians who are worthy heirs to Hindenburg, Brüning, Papen, and Schleicher. He would also have millions of citizens in the United States who acquiesce in inconceivably potent networks of corporate surveillance and control. The artist politician of the future will not bask in the antique aura of Wagner and Nietzsche. He is more likely to take inspiration from the newly minted myths of popular culture. The archetype of the ordinary kid who discovers that he has extraordinary powers is a familiar one from comic books and superhero movies, which play on the adolescent feeling that something is profoundly wrong with the world and that a magic weapon might banish the spell. With one stroke, the inconspicuous outsider assumes a position of supremacy on a battlefield of pure good against pure evil. For most people, such stories remain fantasy, a means of embellishing everyday life. One day, though, a ruthless dreamer, a loner, who has a vague notion of being reserved for something else, may attempt to turn metaphor into reality. He might be out there now, cloaked by the blue light of a computer screen, ready, waiting. Now, I took a lot of that out of context, but the way the article was written, and it is lengthy, it's a typical New Yorker article. The underlying theme of what this writer put together was how easy, because that's always a question, how could a country as technologically, scientifically, intellectually advanced as Germany was in the 20s and 30s, how could that kind of a country descend into genocidal madness that resulted in not just the deaths of 6 million Jews, but the deaths of 50 million people or 60 million people worldwide? How could that have happened? And then the writer goes on to just continue to show the similarities. And he uses all these different titles of books written about Hitler and the rise of Nazism in Germany, all the similarities between the rise of Hitler and the rise of so many of these mass murderers, these despots, these authoritarian or fascist or communist, these killers. How easy, in fact, it was. How they got support from the population that produced them to begin with. And how that support never diminished until it became apparent that the world was ending. And the point the writer's making, at least the point that I took from it, was without saying point by point a comparison of Hitler and Trump, just laying out the facts, the reality of Hitler and Trump, of Hitler supporters and Trump supporters, of the mood of Germany at the time and the mood of the United States now. Now, I realize that Hitler comparisons are becoming tedious. A lot of mainstream media simply will not make the comparison. They won't examine the similarities because, oh, it's a Hitler thing again, which to me doesn't make any sense. There have been a number of mass murderers in the history of the human race, but I think Hitler would certainly reside in the top 10, right? Maybe the top 5. And yet we have, even though mainstream media will just simply not, I mean, they're just getting to the point where they use the word lie where it concerns Trump. But mainstream media seems very, very reluctant to start delivering definite warnings about this country's drift to fascism and what Trump's role is in that drift to fascism. Only it's not a drift any longer. To me, it feels like the beginning of a rush to fascism. Let's take a break here, Kathy. I'll be back in a moment. Stay with me. Our sponsors again tonight, Linda Conroy, who sponsored last night, but since we were off. Ta-da. So, Linda, thank you. Her message, come on, fellow truth seekers, help Mike keep it lit. We need him more than ever. And from Brian Wollman, who also sponsoring tonight, his message, keep up the great podcast. Thanks to both of you, Linda and Brian. And you can participate in our spring fundraiser also, if you choose. Half price for the sponsorships. Instead of $100, it's $50. So go to MikeMolycott.com and follow the prompts. What is Bob Alexander's website? VoicesInOurHeads.com. A couple of people emailed it to us, as did Bob. VoicesInOurHeads.com. I went to the website a few minutes ago. Jesus Christ, he's got a lot of stuff there. I mean, you can go to that website and just spend a week. VoicesInOurHeads.com. And I believe that every single moment with Bob is there somewhere. And I think, aren't the Gumshoe radio, the Mighty Malloy radio players, which we did, oh, I don't know, when was that, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago? Yeah, we had great fun with that. Voices in our head, plural, heads, voicesinourheads.com. Check him out. You'll find that to be a fun website. Woohoo! Now, speaking of Nazism, fascism, Richard Grenell, he was confirmed as U.S. ambassador to Germany. It took a while. But he arrived in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, and according to the New York Times, he wasted no time riling up the German government. I mean, he's supposed to be an ambassador, right? On his first day on the job, he tweeted that German companies doing business in Iran should, quote, wind down operations immediately, end quote, because Trump had decided to unilaterally withdraw from the painstakingly negotiated deal with Iran. So here's U.S. ambassador. As soon as he gets here, he tells the host government, get the fuck out of Iran. Really? Germans were not amused by an ambassador telling them what to do, but that hardly deterred our man in Germany, in Berlin. What he did next was to give an outrageous and insulting interview over the weekend to Breitbart, summarized thus by Breitbart, quote, Trumpian U.S. ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell has expressed great excitement over the wave of conservatism in Europe, saying he wants to empower leaders of the movement, end quote. Conservatism now, especially in Europe, is a code word for fascism, and here too. Fascism. Times editorial board said Mr. Trump was no doubt highly pleased by his envoy, a former United Nations spokesman, Mitt Romney campaign aide, and Fox News contributor, that's our ambassador to Germany, whose confirmation was long held up by congressional critics over this guy's history of provocative tweets and his contempt and disregard that he makes very plain for women. prominent women. But the Time points out one salient fact that I don't the Trump would not agree with this. Ambassadors do not represent a president, they represent a state. And they're not supposed to go around empowering nationalist movements or far-right ideologies in other countries, especially not Germany. They're very sensitive to this shit, and as well they should be. The Germans were furious. Martin Schulz, the former European Parliament president, said, quote, "The new ambassador is behaving not like a diplomat, but like a far-right colonial officer," end quote. And just as this piece of shit in the White House, Grinnell insisted he had been misinterpreted. He said, quote, "Don't put words in my mouth," he tweeted. "The idea that I'd endorse candidates or parties is ridiculous," even though that's just what he did. "I stand by my comments that we are experiencing an awakening from the silent majority, those who reject the elites and their bubble, led by Trump." Sieg Heil? Breitbart is not known for accuracy in reporting, that's the goddamn truth, but just selecting Breitbart, a professed platform for the alt-right, the American Nazis, and all of its lies and conspiracy theories for an interview raised serious questions about Mr. Grinnell's judgment. He knows full well that when Breitbart speaks of conservatism, it doesn't mean the Christian Democratic Party of Chancellor Angela Merkel, the head of the government to which he is accredited. In case that was not clear, Breitbart said the ambassador expressed a deep respect and admiration for the young Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, saying, quote, "Look, I think Sebastian Kurz is a rock star. I'm a big fan." Mr. Kurz, 31, Austria's youngest chancellor, leads the nationalist government in coalition with the far-right pro-Russian Freedom Party that has been sharply critical of Mrs. Merkel for her willingness to accept Muslim immigrants. It may be anachronistic to expect politically appointed American diplomats to fully abide by traditional European standards of diplomatic correctness, and it may be unrealistic to expect that the handpicked envoy of a president who has so totally debased political discourse could be respectful or wise in his utterances. But Mr. Grinnell does not and should not represent the United States. It's just getting more fucked up and more fucked up every day. I mean, oh, stop saying that, Malloy. Say it every night. Rudy Giuliani again. I got to share this with you. You know, he's been I don't know how to describe Giuliani. He's a fucking maniac. He's a liar. He'll do anything for Trump just the same way that Mike Pence would do anything for Trump. Did you see a little bit of film the other day at some meeting? They're all sitting around. It might have been the the hurricane meeting. But they're all sitting there, and to Trump's right is Mike Pence. And for some reason, Trump takes the bottle of water that's sitting in front of everybody. You know, they all get a bottle of water. Trump takes the water, and he puts it under the table. Immediately, Mike Pence does the same thing. He takes his bottle of water and puts it under the table. Jesus Christ. And he didn't even say Simon Says or Trump Says. This Pence is a demon. He is Trump's familiar. I know he is. Anyway, Kim Jong-un, according to Giuliani, begged for a summit on his hands and knees. This happened right after Trump said, fuck it, no, that's off, the first time. After Trump canceled the meeting, Giuliani said, quote, "Well, Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want to put him in." End quote. It's not clear exactly, Daily Kos reports it this way, it's not clear exactly what begging Giuliani was referring to, but whether or not Kim did in fact do anything that could be characterized as begging, whether on his hands and knees or upright via diplomats, no doubt having a top Trump confidant, Giuliani, making this claim to the world will just thrill Kim. Trump and Kim haven't been in enough of a dick-swinging contest so far, so they really needed to add that extra dollop of humiliation and taunting. Ah! Here's something scary. I got an email from Lee in New York. "Hi, Mike. I saw this at Huffington Post. An evangelical university is helping create a movie about how Trump was chosen by God." I can't believe that so-called Christians are doing this, because this has nothing to do with what their own Messiah said. Nothing. In fact, it's exact opposite. Everything about Trump is the exact opposite of what Jesus talked about. And these people who claim to be Christians who are just giving Trump blowjob after blowjob, I mean, it just blows my fucking mind. I can't, you know, I've said before, I was brought up in the Christian belief system, fantasies, whatever you want to call it. I was brought up in it, Methodist at home, Baptist at my grandparents. After a summer with my grandparents, all that Baptist shit, I couldn't wait to get home to Methodist. I was the president of our church's youth fellowship. Moi. Our pastor invited me to his study one day. Huh? No, he wasn't Catholic. He wasn't a priest. And he said, "Mike, the board of deacons would like to pay for you to go to divinity school." Ah! You know, a four-year college degree. I said, I don't understand. "Well, we just think that you have," whatever he said. They wanted me to be a preacher. And I probably would have been a good one. No, I will admit that. I would have been a good preacher. But I told Reverend Jones, that was his name, I just said, "Reverend Jones, I appreciate it, but I'm not." I was only 17 at the time. I said, "I'm not, I couldn't do that." So he dropped it. So as far as Christianity is concerned, I'm kind of like an observant Jew, you know, a kid who was bar mitzvah, went through the whole shmeal, went, you know, spent a week in Israel, like any good Jewish kid would do, came back, you know, maybe he went to, I won't say went to a yeshiva, but he sure as hell went to Sunday school, and he went to temple, and his parents made sure that he was a good Jew. And then all of a sudden, he says, "You know, this is bullshit. This is bullshit. I'm not a Jew any longer." Of course, the parents freak out. I mean, "Ah!" "Well, what are you then?" "I'm a Buddhist," or whatever. But I know I have some friends who are apostate Jews. I really do. And the they don't even celebrate the High Holy Days anymore. Well, there's one couple. They still do the Seder dinner. What is that? Passover, yeah. They leave the door open for Isaiah, Joshua. It is what it is. It's very interesting. But Christians putting together a movie about how Trump was chosen by God? Oh, fuck. I mean, anyway, Lee sent this to me. He says, what amazes me is that these people of faith see God as all-powerful and has blessed them and their nation, yet has also allowed horrible things to happen. God loves us, but September 11th happened. God gave us Trump, but don't you think he gave us Obama too? The South is religious and suffers hurricanes. Or is that God blowing a kiss? If you want to look for justification in text, you will find it. Misinterpretations may be necessary, but it can be achieved. These people do not know the Bible or this nation's founding documents. The Constitution does not declare this to be a Christian nation. If they read the original draft of Jefferson's Declaration, they would know that Christian, capital C, Christian, is used to insult the king's actions as being contrary to religious teaching. And then he cites a text below written by Jefferson. This is what Jefferson wrote, referring to King George. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty. In the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither, this piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and that his assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished die, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one person with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. Now, I have to admit, I'm lost in that. I don't know exactly what Jefferson is saying. Yeah, he's speaking against slavery. But Jefferson owned slaves. He's speaking against the degrading aspect of slave owner and the enslaved person. And yet, Jefferson had several children with Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman who was on his plantation. I don't know what the hell he's saying here. I really don't. I appreciate you sent it to me, Lee, but this really has me kind of... I guess what Lee is trying to say, he's just mocking the fact that King George presented himself as this great Christian. But creating a movie about how Trump was chosen by God, what? And of course, I'm sure Trump is he excretes stuff when he gets this kind of adulation. This is not praise. This is not admiration. This is adulation. Ah! Trump, there's just very little to say about it. Oh, and Trump shows his endless, boundless ignorance with Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau. CNN reported this yesterday, and apparently it's happened last month. According to CNN, on May 25th, Trump and Trudeau were discussing the Trump administration imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada. Trump says the tariffs are a matter of national security, something Trudeau reportedly contested during the phone call. Trump reportedly said in response after Trudeau said something to the effect, you know, what are you talking about? Tariffs. This is Canada. Trump said, quote, didn't you guys burn down the White House? Trump, in his endless ignorance, was probably referring to the War of 1812. The Canadians did not burn down the White House. That was the British. But what the fuck does Trump? Trump doesn't know anything. And it wasn't just the White House. Practically all of Washington. Now, the British marched into Washington, D.C. on such and such a date in 1814. After the American military attacked York, Ontario province. That territory, part of Canada, at the time was a British colony. So if you wanted to really press the point, it was the United States that invaded Canada. Oh, well, fuck it. Now, Trump bragged in March that he's made up facts during his meeting with Trudeau. Trump is a lying piece of shit. He really is. Didn't you people burn down the White House? Now, in the age of Trump, I get the sense, I don't know if you do, I would assume that if you're out and about, in your life, but if you're also paying attention to, you know, local news and what's happening now in Trump world, you come across these stories. But this one, two women, Megan Stackhouse and her fiance, Lucinda Mann. Okay, they're lesbians. I spent last Friday night going to a carnival in Bend, Oregon. It was hosted by a local cider company. They joked about how pricey the drinks were at the carnival and laughed about not having the nerve to ride a carnival ride there called the Zipper. I don't do carnival rides. But what was supposed to be a relaxing date night for these two women, recently engaged, quickly turned into a brutal road rage nightmare that would leave both women injured and a man arrested on felony assault charges, according to police there. The man, and there's a picture of him at Washington Post website, and he looks like your typical Trump supporter. Shaved head, overweight. He's got that slack fucking jawed look, dead eyes. You know what I'm talking about. White with a little tinge of red. Just, you know, got those lips and that face that just says, oh, fucking trouble resides there. Okay. He's 49 years old, Jay Barbeau. He was arraigned Monday in county court on three counts of assault and a single count of criminal mischief and reckless driving, according to the Oregonian newspaper. He's still in jail. All right, here's what happened. Traffic was heavy as the couple made their way home from the carnival at about 8 p.m. Friday, according to Megan Stackhouse. Said in an interview with the Washington Post, at the wheel of her brand new Kia, this woman, 34-year-old woman, tried maneuvering through the cars to find a space to merge onto the road. She tried squeezing in the space in front of a black Toyota truck, and the driver, Barbeau, became infuriated. Barbeau gunned the Toyota's engine, scooting forward in an attempt to force Miss Stackhouse back, but she pulled in front of him anyway. Barbeau started yelling, flipping her off and flashing his lights. About a half block down the road, Miss Stackhouse came to a crosswalk and stopped her car. Barbeau stepped out of his truck and started walking toward Miss Stackhouse and Lucinda Mann, who was in the passenger seat. But Stackhouse put it in gear and drove off. Reaching a roundabout about a half mile later, Barbeau was tailgating Stackhouse so closely that she could no longer see his headlights or the license plate. She said, "I really thought he was about to rear end me," so she decided to pull over and let this asshole pass. But instead of passing, this hideous-looking fucking Nazi slammed on his brakes. He stepped out of his truck, punched the back window of Stackhouse's Kia, shattering the glass. He punched out the driver's side taillight, and then he attacked Megan Stackhouse. Now, Stackhouse's door, her side of the car, was locked. Her window was rolled down. Barbeau reached into the window, grabbed her right arm, twisted it, and broke it. He punched her in the face, breaking her glasses. The other woman, Lucinda Mann, stepped out of the car and approached Barbeau to try to protect Miss Stackhouse, but he threw Mann to the ground where she hit her head and was knocked unconscious. Megan Stackhouse described this freak as, quote, stocky, heavyset, muscular, and intimidating, 5'8", 245 pounds. A woman sitting in the passenger seat of the assailant's Toyota yelled at him to get in the truck. Let's go. But Megan Stackhouse stood in the way. With her fiancé unconscious on the ground, Miss Stackhouse worried that Barbeau would try to run over her. She tried to take a photograph of his license plate with her phone. But she said, quote, "My arm was so broken, I couldn't make it work," end quote. And that's when she saw a police vehicle heading northbound on the street. The police said Barbeau was trying to flee the scene as police were approaching. Officers interviewed witnesses and arrested Barbeau, who told police that the women had cut him off. The woman in Barbeau's car said, "Those two dykes are faking their injuries." Faking their injuries. Fucking broken arm, right? Miss Stackhouse and Miss Mann were transported by ambulance to a hospital where they were treated for their injuries. Miss Mann reportedly suffered a neck injury in addition to a concussion. Stackhouse suffered a bruised temple and a broken wrist. She later found a lens from her glasses in the backseat of her car. She said, quote, "That's how hard he hit me in the face," end quote. She underwent surgery Monday, during which doctors placed a plate, several pins, and screws into her broken radius. Stackhouse said, quote, "Doctors did say that it's likely I will have chronic pain from this sort of injury." She said she still feels terrified by what happened. She said, quote, "I can't help but think, what if he had a gun? I'm still worried about my personal safety from any kind of retribution that might come back to me about this. It's definitely a pretty upsetting experience, and I feel like it's going to take a long time to work through all the feelings that are brought up. This is not the sort of thing I would like to think happens in my town," end quote. Well, you can call me or accuse me of stereotyping, and that's okay because that's exactly what I'm doing. Trump supporters are easily stereotyped, very easily. They're white. They're ugly, the men and the women. The men are overweight. The women look like they just had their last goddamn line of crank. They have splotchy skin. The men usually have shaved heads and some kind of Nazi or Klan or Confederate junk on them. The women, well, they're illiterate, dysfunctional. I'm sure the couples experience all sorts of marital violence or couples violence, but it's probably tit for tat until finally the big bruising Nazi kills the woman, which eventually he will do. But they're Trump supporters. They love him. Fuck. Do a break, please, Catherine. I'll be back in a moment. Woo! One more time, our sponsors tonight. One is a holdover from last night since we had a repeat show. Linda Conroy. Thanks, Linda. Her message, come on, fellow truth seekers, help Mike keep it lit. We need him more than ever. And Brian Wallman, who wrote Keep Up the Great Podcast. So to Brian and Linda, thank you both very much for the sponsorships. You can sponsor the program for $50. It's usually $100, but from now until the end of spring, the beginning of summer, the summer solstice, it's $50. Thank you. There's a guy who's running for Congress in Virginia. He's running as a Libertarian for the state's 10th district. The seat is currently held by Barbara Comstock. I'm sure you're familiar with her, a Republican. His name is Nathan Larson, and he spends most of his time on the internet in between his intermittent work as an accountant. Now, this guy wants to be a congressman. This 10th district, it covers three counties in Northern Virginia outside the Washington suburbs. But here's what he believes in. This is another example, just like these extreme examples of road rage. Here's another example of the madness that Trump doesn't cause this madness, but he unlocks it in people who have been forced by society or by societal norms to keep their insanity in check, except maybe to beat their spouses or beat their children until eventually they wind up in jail or something. But these public displays of madness is a direct consequence of having Trump in a position he's in. But listen to this guy. Nathan Larson lives with his parents. He believes he's 37. You talk about failure to launch. 37, yeah, okay. He believes in instituting a patriarchal system with women under the authority, the complete authority of men. He supports abolishing age restrictions for marriage. He supports abolishing laws against marital rape. He believes that white supremacy is, quote, a system that works. He believes that Hitler was, quote, a good thing for Germany. And he believes that incest should be legalized. And at one point in a conversation with the Washington Post, yeah, they interviewed him, he expressed admiration for the system run by the Taliban in Afghanistan. He noted that the country's birth rate fell as a result of increased opportunities for women after the United States intervened in that country. He doesn't like that. He wants lots of white babies. He's running as a libertarian. Jesus Christ. Oh, he also is one of these incel types, which which stands for involuntary celibacy, because he can't get laid. You know, he probably spends time on the internet, not just building his website or adding to his website, but also going to various porn sites where he can have sex with his hand. But an incel, that's an offshoot of Breitbart and the white supremacists and the racist pigs in this country. Incel. These are white men who are very pissed off that they are forced into what they call involuntary celibacy because they can't get laid. And that's certainly understandable. Now, I'm being very flip about this, but this is what they honestly, truthfully believe, that women are deliberately and consciously refusing to give it up to them. And therefore, they are forced either to rape or into involuntary celibacy. And they already have reduced that those two long words, involuntary, that's five syllables, celibacy, that's four more. They got it down to incel. Sounds like something out of 1984, doesn't it? The incel crowd. I'm in with the incels. Jesus Christ, I'm going crazy, Kathy. But this is a sub-genre of this white crazy shit that's just roaming the countryside right now. Jesus fucking Christ. You know, I wish I were a different race right now. I can't stand white. I mean, whatever color, I'm not white, but, you know, I'm mostly Italian. And the Italians were not even considered white for a while. Neither were the Irish, for that matter, right? But I'm to the point, and I don't mean this in a negative way to my black brothers and sisters, but I'm almost to the point where I wish I had more. Somebody texted me today. She says she wished she had more melanin in her skin. Melanin, is that the stuff that makes your skin dark? She said, she called herself melanin deprived. Because I think she's tired the same way I am of being associated. You know, I've said before, it's hard enough being a white person today. To me, it is. Maybe you've reconciled it, no problem. It's hard enough being a white person and then being a white man. Oh, fuck. And then being a white man, a white American man. I mean, zip, 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 three strikes. There you are. I'm out. Speaking of out, we're out of time. What a note to close the show on, or the podcast. Where the fuck this is? I'll see you tomorrow, okay? In the meantime, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.